Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to an amazing artist and educator named Renee Neblett about a fascinating venture to create a sustainable livelihood for people in Ghana. I'm very happy now to welcome Linda Tarr Whalen. She's the author of the book Women Lead the Way, Your Guide to Stepping Up to Leadership and Changing the World. She has served as ambassador to the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. She was the CEO for the Center for Policy Alternatives, and she's a senior fellow at the think tank Demos. She travels widely to speak about women's issues and women's leadership. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So you write that having women in decision-making roles, in leadership roles, affects not only who decides, but what is decided. In other words, what the agenda is. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a really important point that has somehow slipped past us in terms of the thinking about the changes that we need in our society. When there's a critical mass of women, which is about 30%, in my book I call that the 30% solution, when there's 30% or more women at the table, there is attention to a set of issues that just simply haven't been considered to be priorities. In businesses, it includes things like having a longer time horizon, being risk-aware but not crazy about risk, thinking about the bottom line in a different way that includes relationships with employees and with clients and consumers and so forth. When you're in government, it means paying attention to a whole set of issues like healthcare, education, family and work policies, things that really we've been saying, women have been saying certainly, for a long time are very important to a quality of life, but we just never seem to make any progress.
So when women actually do take leadership, and you have this number 30%, which I guess is some kind of critical mass, what happens different? I mean, what is qualitatively different in terms of the decisions that are made?
Well, it is really a different style of decision-making. Balanced leadership is what this is really all about, of having this critical mass of women. Incidentally, the 30% is not a ceiling here. It's really a floor. We don't get a lot of these changes unless we get 30%, but I'm all for getting 50% or more. And I think that it's important for people here in this country to recognize that around the world, this benchmark has been in place since, I guess about 1995. And the difference really is that women bring, I call it the difference makes. We bring a different appreciation or emphasis on relationships and teamwork and partnerships and collaboration, all incredibly important elements to having better decisions than what we've seen with, say, the big automobile companies or the big finance companies, which essentially had boards consisting of only men. The other kinds of differences that are made is women are more likely to try and drive for a solution to the problem rather than to actually keep things going in the same way, the status quo. They're not as heavily invested in the status quo. And we had one really good example of that recently when we had this big financial meltdown in the United States. And two women stepped up, Republican women senators, and said, you know, my party is terribly important, but I think the country needs us to come to some agreement about what we can do to stimulate this economy. I wasn't at all surprised to find out that it was women who led the way there, because this driving for consensus and for solutions is another hallmark of women's leadership.
You make an interesting and important distinction between crisis management and crisis prevention. And apparently women are better at crisis prevention. Is this really true?
Yeah, women have a different sort of value system. And it's an interesting story in the book about how I first learned about this before I read any research or anything. I was leading a group of women who had come together, I had brought together for a women's economic summit. This was about in 1992, I would guess. And at any rate, we brought them all together, and we had put aside 3 hours on the agenda to develop what were the values that women thought were different from the values that were the common ones in making decision-making. And these were women from the top of business, from both political parties, from universities and foundations and grassroots organizations. And in a very short time, I think it was something like a half an hour, they had this list of differences in values, like putting a value on prevention of problems as opposed to waiting until the crisis happens. If you look at the healthcare debate, you'll see a lot of that from the standpoint of women coming out very strongly in favor of more primary care doctors, more prevention programs, being sure kids get taken care of to prevent the kinds of illnesses that can cause them lifetime damage. That's a good example of this prevention versus just, you know, kind of like waiting till it all falls down and there's a great big crisis.
Women are also good, I should say we, at long-term thinking, which goes hand-in-hand with what you're talking about. When we talk about our business model, we have a very strong emphasis on quarterly performance of businesses. Getting away from that means changing the infrastructure in a really profound way. I mean, changing the way things work. Do you have a vision for how to get outside of that short-term thinking economically?
Well, you know, it's a really good question, and I've struggled with this. My sense really is that the one thing I can put my finger on that we've never tried is to have enough women at the table to change the dynamics there where those decisions are made, where there's nobody saying that the long term is what really counts here. There is a mutual fund here in the United States now, relatively new, that's called the Women's Equity Fund, which is one of these sustainable investment funds. And their whole emphasis is that if you have enough women in leadership in corporations, that they are the best long-term investment because, in fact, over time, they will shift, perhaps, from being quarterly oriented to being longer term. You know, this kind of super competition for the next quarter, we now can see has gotten us into a lot of trouble in this country. And I really feel like this idea is one we haven't tried right now. There's 14% women on corporate boards, almost the same as it's been for the last 8 or 9 years, 3% women CEOs of the big companies. There's only 12 companies out of the Fortune 500 that have 30% on their board, and three of those are headed by women. So this is a model that we really haven't tested in the business world. You asked about business, but we also haven't tested this short-termism in the political arena as well. Usually there, it's rather than the quarter, it's the next election that's coming along, and can we get any longer-term thinking in solving the problems of the country? Again, this country's way behind other countries in what proportion of women we have in our national Congress. We are 69th in the world. I find that really outrageous. The United States is 69th in the world in the proportion of women in our Congress. And we've slid down. In the last 15 years, we've gone from 42nd to 69th. And that's really because other countries have pulled ahead of us. We have more women in Congress now than we've ever had before. But the incremental growth in that, you know, the number of new people is so tiny that, in fact, other countries are moving way ahead of where we are. And so I really think if we want to shift the thinking, we've got to shift who's making the decisions.
When I read that in your book, at first I was surprised, but then I really wasn't surprised, because when you think about the United States, you think about a kind of U.S. competitiveness, you know, that we're number one attitude, the huge emphasis on military spending. And in order to keep those things in place, you almost have to have a suppression of women's leadership.
Yeah, you do. That's exactly right. I'm not sure that people sit around and think about it in exactly those terms, Mary Charlotte, but certainly that's what happens. If you want to preserve what you've got, the status quo right now is, in fact, what you said, the military-industrial complex, the short-term gains, and that's what people are trying to preserve because that's the way they do it. If we want to change that, you know, we can't expect something different. If we keep the same people doing the same things, we're not going to get a different result. So one of the dynamics that I think is possible to change is who's sitting at that power table.
We're talking to Linda Tarr Whalen. Her book is called Women Lead the Way, Your Guide to Stepping Up to Leadership and Changing the World. So women got the vote 89 years ago, and you have a vision of the year 2020, the 100th anniversary of the women's vote. But let's talk about the progress that we've made and the progress that we haven't made as women. Where are we right now?
Well, first of all, I'm the first one to say we've made a lot of progress. I entered the workforce in 1960 as a nurse. I had graduated from a hospital school of nursing and was fired on my first day on the job because I was unfortunately busy helping a patient with an IV, and I was sitting down and didn't stand up when a doctor walked in the room. Well, nothing like that would happen today. Nurses are now considered much more in terms of their professionalism. Nurses actually are getting better pay. Nurses are involved in the healthcare reform issues. Nurses still tell me that their voices are not heard as effectively as if they were doctors, but things have really changed. And they've changed for us in terms of the workforce. Women bring an enormous amount of strength now to our country and our economy. Women have been the majority of college graduates now for quite some time, equal or the majority of graduates in big professions like, medicine and law. Women are just getting graduate degrees in a higher proportion as men. This is what a knowledge society is really supposed to be all about, and women are really excelling. We've put a lot of effort into getting into a different place. And what I see right now is that while we've made a huge amount of progress, women in the workforce, there's a lot of hanging over issues that haven't been addressed. The wage gap is only closing, for example, the gap between women and men at a half a cent a year over time. That's, these things are just too slow. The family and work balance question, our kids are now in their 40s. We have grandchildren, and our children are facing the same problems with trying to be sure that they can take care of their family well and take care of bringing the money into the family at the same time, the same problems we had 40 years ago. So some of these, no matter how hard we've advocated, no matter how much research there is about how, it would be more productive for companies to have flexible work hours, and it would be better for society, and even the environment would be better if we had flexible working hours. We're not moving very fast. So we have made progress, wonderful progress, but we haven't gotten as far as certainly I would like to see us get.
There has always been a really wide pay gap between traditionally women's professions and traditionally men's professions, like nurses and teachers tend to be underpaid and so on. What about men and women doing the exact same job, two doctors or two business people or whatever?
Well, it's still, there's a big gap in any of the professions. I don't think there's any one where women make more than men after 20 years in the profession. I've never seen one of those situations. And in fact, sometimes there are very large gaps. There was a study done by the Institute for Women's Policy Research, which is a really good research institution in Washington, and they looked at women and men who both had graduated from college about 20 years ago, and they then compared where the salaries were now for those same professions. And they found that the gap was big enough that for women it was almost $500,000 difference in the gap totally of what they could expect to earn compared to what men were earning. Now, some of that is this question of who moves into leadership. Some of it is into the question of how much we penalize women who move out of the workforce for a short time to take care of a family, a new child or an adopted child. We just have not moved into the realm where other countries have been for a long time to say that is part of life, that you have, as Sylvia Hewlett has called it, on-ramps and off-ramps, and there are times when you must step aside. We talk a great deal about men at home being the people at home and women being in the workforce, and we do see more of that. My husband was a stay-at-home dad for a while in our marriage. But in fact, there's, I think it's 11 million stay-at-home moms and 200,000 stay-at-home dads at the moment. So we haven't balanced that out, and it is indeed a real problem for families today.
I think it shows up in a lot of ways. If you're going to take on the stress of leadership, because it's not easy to lead a company or to be in government or any of that, if you're a woman, chances are not very high that you're going to have full-time, unpaid spousal labor and all the support that goes along with it. How do women, or could they, compensate for that?
Well, in fact, women won't have that based on the statistics out there. You're exactly right. Well, I tried to deal with this in the book. You know, half the book is really about the business case of why women bring so much strength that we can't afford not to have them at the power tables. But the other half of the book, the sort of your guide to stepping up to leadership, is full of ideas and tips for women as individuals and those of us together, and men who care about these issues, to actually make the change happen. So I do talk about how to build a support system for yourself. I also talk about the fact that often coming inside is your into a leadership position is your opportunity to make change happen. Women often don't negotiate for themselves when they are offered a leadership position. They don't negotiate the salary. They don't negotiate the hours. There's a sort of assumption that I cannot do that, whereas men do. I just did a talk in New York with a group of professional women, and one of the women there was an executive coach. And she said, you know, one of the hardest things I do is to try and get women who are, in fact, incredibly capable and ready to move up, that when they're offered a position, to negotiate for what it is they need in order to take that position. She said they start out below the guys anyway because they don't go in and say, you know, I need to work at home on Fridays, or I need to have flexible working hours because of this and that. So I think we still got to be a little bit more direct and forceful about negotiating for ourselves, as well as breaking through the glass ceilings that still exist.
We're talking to Linda Tarr Whalen. Her book is called Women Lead the Way, Your Guide to Stepping Up to Leadership and Changing the World. You talked a moment ago about the real lack of public or corporate safety net for most people. In countries where you have that, can you correlate that with more women in government making those safety nets happen in the first place?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not sure which is the chicken and which is the egg. But let's use France for an example, because, I mean, there are lots of other countries, but that's not considered one that's usually used as an example in this country. They have 50-50 in their parliament. They did it by changing the laws of the country, and the political parties then nominate people so that they can fill 50-50. It's a different electoral system, so it's perhaps a little bit easier than it would be in the United States, where we don't think much of any kind of quota. But they also have, and have had for some years, some of the best early child care and early education programs in the world. They have had their creches for small babies. They have had paid family leave when you have a child. They've had children's allowances. They've essentially said, we really value families and children, and we value women being able to work. Is it easy? No, of course, it's not easy. But is it easier? Yes, it really is. So more women really does make a difference in the agenda. It's certainly true at the European level. It's true in a number of countries that have paid attention to this set of issues. And there's a new resurgence around the world that you cannot be successful. You can't compete successfully or build a good economy if half your talent's outside the door. So some of the countries that have done the most to increase women in government are countries like India and South Africa. The top country in the world is Rwanda, that after the civil war there and the terrible genocide of one tribe against another tribe, they said, if we're going to have a country that works, we've got to change who's leading the country. So we haven't had this conversation very much. We talk about women as in terms of what women need, We, you know, sort of advocate and bang on the door from the outside. And what we need, in addition, is more insider champions who take this and run with it and make sure that we make the changes that, you know, are a little overdue in this country.
I think it's important to note that the qualities of leadership that you're talking about are not strictly gender-bound. And I say that if you think of the comparison between Barack Obama and Sarah Palin. Some men are already leading with the priorities that you ascribe to women, and some women are not.
That's absolutely true. And I get the Sarah Palin question fairly often, sometimes as the Margaret Thatcher question, but, you know, do you really want to have people like this in power? But here's the odds. If you're gonna play the odds, we've been playing the odds that we're gonna have enough men at the table who will be champions for these issues, and I feel like Barack Obama is an entirely different kind of man, a different kind of leader, and I haven't seen very many of those. You know, I just think that if you're gonna play the odds are if you have more women at the table as a balance, you're going to get that change to happen. Now, I think the fact that Barack Obama is an African-American man who's a partner with a woman who at one point was actually his mentor and his, maybe even his boss, certainly his mentor and colleague in the legal profession, is representative of a new generation of leaders. And I do think we'll see more men who actually get it, you know, that will lead in these ways as well. But what I'm saying is I think women are going to have to lead the way with men to make the changes, not women against men, but women have got to lead to a different place than where we are today.
Some of the things blocking women's leadership are infrastructure and so on that we've talked about. Some of them are also inner problems. Women with leadership abilities may still lack confidence in themselves. How do you address that?
Well, I address that in the book quite a bit, and that really surprised me, to tell you the truth. I went out and did 12 focus groups with women of all different ages and doing different work and, you know, moms and single young women and career women, all different kinds of people. And I didn't expect this confidence question to come up, and it did across the board. It was one of those things where it was clear that people would say, well, I had an opportunity, but I didn't take it because I didn't think I was ready. And in the book, I use a story that happened to me when I was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. And I went in to meet with the man who was then the Secretary General of the U.N., Kofi Annan, because the United States wanted more women in top leadership. This was in the Clinton administration, and it was a major priority to have more women in leadership. And he said, I totally agree with you. Ultimately, he appointed women to head all of the largest agencies in the U.N., or most of the largest agencies in the U.N., so he really was trying to change the direction of where things had gone. But he said to me, I've got a problem, and maybe you can help me with it. He said, you know, I've been in this U.N. civil service system for most of my life, and I've always been interested in people moving up. He's an African man. He's from Ghana, as a matter of fact. I've always been interested, particularly women and people from the South, the developing South. And he said, so I would say to someone, oh, this promotion is available. You really ought to apply for that. And he said, overwhelmingly, women said to me, well, I don't think I have enough experience, or I really think I have to go back to school before I can do that. And he said, and I never said that to a man that he didn't say, oh, thank you, I will. And the thing is, Mary Charlotte, when I use that example with audiences, all the heads nod. I gave a talk at American University not very long ago, and at the end a woman came up and she said, I'm the deputy manager of the foundation giving program for the university, she said. And recently I was contacted by my original college where I graduated, and they were looking for a director of foundation giving, and they said they would like me to apply. And she said, and I said to them that I don't know if I have enough experience. And after I thought about this story with Kofi Annan, I decided tomorrow that I'm going to call them up and tell them that I'm going to apply for the job. So we hold ourselves back a bit, and I deal in the book quite a bit with sort of how do you gauge your own personal confidence factor, how can you increase your confidence and that of other women, women that you know, women that you just happen to meet, women you work with, young girls, all of those things I think are very, very important. And we each have the power as one person to be able to start some of those changes.
I found it fascinating that a study had shown that white young women were less interested in leadership than young women of color. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And the difference is, this was a Girl Scout study, a very large study by the Girl Scouts, right, who are very devoted to leadership for girls. And they, I think, were as surprised as you were in seeing the study. And that's true. They showed that Caucasian girls were holding themselves back. African-American and Latino girls, particularly African-American girls, were interested in becoming leaders. And yet, we all know they're facing even more closed doors than the Caucasian girls are. So we have to do something to raise the level of desire among girls to be leaders and the recognition that you can be a leader wherever you are. You could be a leader in the dance. You could be a leader in the community. You could be, a leader in your church. It doesn't mean that you have to go for a government job or run for office, although I sure hope a lot more women do that. It's a different kind of way to think about how you can make a difference in the world. And women, overwhelmingly in the polls and so forth, say that they really do want to make a difference. They want to have a job where it can make a difference, or they want to make a difference with their family or their community. And this is really one way to do it.
We're talking to Linda Tarr-Whalen. Her book is called Women Lead the Way, Your Guide to Stepping Up to Leadership and Changing the World. Another thing that women come up against is gender stereotypes and an overemphasis on their appearance. And I see this all the time, even by women journalists writing in such publications as the New York Times. When there's a woman leader, they're more likely to describe in detail her hairstyle and things like that. How does this question of what women look like and other stereotypes about women's personalities, what does it look like in the workplace, and how does it affect women's abilities to step up to leadership positions?
Well, it's definitely true. All we had to do is to watch the presidential campaign last year and see an incredible amount of it aimed both at Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was my candidate, so it affected me more watching that, but I'm sure women who had Sarah Palin as a candidate might have felt the same way. It's called the double bind dilemma. Women, if you're sweet and nice, then you're considered too soft. If you're tough and quote aggressive, I don't think there are any aggressive men. There's just aggressive women somehow. But if you are, then you're considered to be a bitch. This has been around for a long time. It's the appearance, but it's also the actions. What way do you act? My real advice is to call people on it and to be who you are. I went through the period. I headed up the lobbying operation for the National Education Association for a while on Capitol Hill, and it was at a period when any woman who was up there as a lobbyist really almost looked like a guy. I mean, we had our dark suits on and our white blouses with a bow on them and, very somber. And, well, now I just don't dress like that. And I think I dress, appropriately. You always should. But we've got to be ourselves, and we've got to stop sort of looking for approval against a model that doesn't necessarily fit. It's like the old story about the square peg and the round hole. You just can't make them go together. So I'm all about women understanding what's there, realizing those are stereotypes and myths, and I do a whole chapter about some other myths and stereotypes as well, and moving beyond them to be who we are. I don't think that's easy, but I think it's better than always trying to be somebody you're not.
I have to say that I've really started noticing the use of the adjectives hard and soft for qualities that really have nothing to do with actual physical hardness or softness, nor with gender, but you can suddenly make anything masculine or feminine by calling it hard and soft. And that's another thing to really watch out for.
That's a very interesting observation. You're right about that.
So leadership ability is to some extent a gift, like any other gift for science or poetry or music or whatever. And just being a woman is not a qualification for leadership. Given that women do have self-confidence problems, how does a person, a woman, evaluate if she has what it takes to be a good leader?
Well, I think, first of all, the biggest issue is don't underestimate yourself when you're looking at whether you can be a good leader or not. If you really see in front of you a goal of something you want to accomplish, you want to make a change, whether it's to get a traffic light at your corner for where the kids are crossing the street, and in order to get that, you have to step up and begin to think about, well, who could make that happen? How can I get other people to join with me to make that happen? How do we present the fact that it's an important thing to do? What do I need to know before I can do that? If you have a desire to make something different, that's how you can step up into leadership, as far as I'm concerned. It's not just about positions. It really is about making a change, changing the world, making something better. So that's one thing is, a lot of those issues women start with, and they do make the change, but then they don't see themselves as a leader who accomplished it. In fact, that's kind of another hidden issue that a lot of women who are leaders don't know they are or don't see themselves as leaders. They sort of have this sense, well, anybody could do it, I think, or something like that. Now, the other thing that I would say about this question is you got to look at who's already there. Women wanting to run for office, whether this is, the school board or the United States Senate or being a governor, often evaluate themselves and think they fall short, like the example I used of needing more education or needing more experience. But when you look at who's there or who's been there, you say to yourself, well, wait just a second. I can do as good a job, if not a better job. And I think that the values and the abilities I bring to this could make things better than the people who are already there. I think it's real important to take a look around at who's already got that, quote, leader, label across their forehead and see if they deserve to have the leader, the name leader attached to them, and whether, in fact, a lot of women couldn't do as good a job, if not better.
One of the things that I found fascinating was there's a quotation in your book, the sales generated by women-owned businesses equal the gross domestic product of China. So women, basically economic growth at this point in history is totally very much fueled by women.
It really is. I mean, most people have seen the statistic that women are starting businesses twice as fast as men. And yet we have this sense, and certainly in terms of policy terms, your state of New Mexico is actually an exception here because they have done programs for women business owners for quite some years. But generally it's considered as if this was just like, something on the side, marginal, not very important. So I tried to put the statistics in a different kind of a framework. The Economist, which is a weekly business magazine that's produced in Britain but it's got a worldwide circulation, has done a series of special issues on what they call womenomics, which is women in the economy. And the tagline they use is forget China, forget India, forget the Internet. The driving force for economic growth is women. And yet we don't, like I was saying earlier about how many women there are at the table, we don't pay a lot of attention to it. So I tried to look at a way to balance the statistics so that it would cause attention to what a wonderful strength this is for our economy and for the business community. There is a quiz in the book, actually, to test out our knowledge of a lot of these issues, because I find that we see something or hear about it in the press, and it just kind of goes past, and we don't have a way to draw the context of what does that mean in the larger sense of things. And this is the one of the examples of, that I try to use is the women business owners.
How do you see women substantively addressing the prevention of violence, poverty, and war? That seems like that would probably be our greatest strengths, besides the economic element.
Yeah, well, those issues are a bit different in how I would see them playing out. But in terms of poverty, the women's foundations have really led the way in this country using a model that is used now by the World Bank and other international organizations to try and end poverty, which is helping women, poor women, become self-sufficient. You know, an enormous proportion of people who are poor are women and children, about two-thirds in this country, a little higher than that around the world. So rather than thinking about just an income replacement program, which has been the focus of our welfare efforts in, you know, to a large degree, with women, quote, moving off the welfare system in 5 years and not being able to go to college while they're on welfare in many, many states, this is a different model. It's a model that really works. The statistics show that they work. But it comes from the women's community. It is a different way to think about poverty, and now it's being adopted by international organizations, but not yet here in the United States. It is not very much part of any governmental efforts, that, which are usually the large-scale ways to fight poverty. With regard to peace and security, it's a really interesting question that while women always test higher on things like international cooperation and negotiation and peacekeeping, in fact, there have been very, very few women ever at the peace tables in terms of, you know, we're now with our third woman Secretary of State, which is really quite terrific in terms of what difference that could potentially make. But in fact, the UN 10 years ago passed a resolution in the Security Council about having more women in peacekeeping, more women, you know, at the peace tables to negotiate peace agreements, and more women in the reconstruction processes of countries. And they just had a special session of the UN because they hadn't moved very far. Most countries had not moved very far in about 10 years on this. It's one of those issues where we're still giving a lot of lip service, but not so much real attention to it. The issue of violence is a third issue that you raised. And, you know, it's really an interesting problem that we finally have recognized domestic violence and rape on the streets and rape as an instrument of war and sexual harassment as all sexual violence on a continuum. It's not as if they're totally separate issues. They are power issues where usually men against women, overwhelmingly men against women, use violence and power in order to get their way. Once we began to recognize that, then the first thing was that women created, like, domestic violence shelters. That was all led by women advocates. I mean, really and truly. Then the international, the Violence Against Women Act, which was probably now 15 or 18 years ago, we decided to see some men leaders of both political parties and some business leaders begin to realize that this was a very expensive problem for the country. It was expensive for businesses as well as being something that challenged the health and dignity and respect of women themselves. So Vice President Biden and Senator Hatch were the two sponsors initially of the Violence Against Women Act. But we've never funded that very much. In fact, domestic violence shelters, rape crisis centers, all of those programs are still largely funded by volunteers with tiny amounts of money. And we've just recently, in the last maybe 5 or 8 years, begun to realize that what we have to do is, yes, we have to support women who are the victims, but in fact, they're not the perpetrators of this. What do we do to change the discussion, the dialogue, the training, the expectations of boys and men about what their power means. What is it? What's acceptable to be a man and use your power to beat up on someone else? So we still have a ways to go on all three of those issues. But in my context, the changes that we need, in fact, are the ones that women are talking about. And women need to be there to say, this is the way we really should do it. Here's why, here's how, and we can solve this. we can stop only talking about the problem and talk about the problem in terms of the solutions that are possible.
Linda Tarr-Whalen is author of the book Women Lead the Way, Your Guide to Stepping Up to Leadership and Changing the World. She served as ambassador to the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women, is a senior fellow at the think tank Demos. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm delighted now to welcome Renee Neblett. She is an artist, an educator. She's the director of the Kokrobite Institute, which is in Ghana, West Africa. And she is here showcasing a product that has just been launched. They're called the Sasa Bags. And they are going to be shown tomorrow, Thursday night, from 4 to 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Weaving Gallery on Galisteo Street. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So you are doing an incredibly interesting project in Ghana, which brings a huge wealth of experience that you have as an artist and designer to Africa, and you are really opening up a whole conversation about design in Africa with your American, European, African-American roots and the various cultures that are in Ghana coming together in a conversation, and all sorts of new ideas and products are coming out of this.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's really interesting. As you know, we started out with a recycling project, and that really had to do with just watching how the landscape was being so attacked by the excessive use of plastic. You know, and Ghana has a whole, is like most of Africa, is very visual. And there's these Adinkra symbols. And one day I was going through them, and there was the Adinkra symbol called Asasa Yejuru, which essentially means the earth has providence. And when the young boy said that to me, I thought, wow, there's a culture, a sensibility about recycling in the culture that people aren't really thinking about anymore. So we made this kind of reusable bag out of flower sacks and called it Asasa Yejuru. And we printed that on these pouches. So you had this little flower sack bag that could be put in a pouch and you could take it shopping. And the idea was to get people to not need to take as much plastic, but to carry this little sack with them. And it matured and it was great. But we found that the average person, kind of middle class Ghanaians, didn't like it. They didn't think it was pretty enough or aesthetic enough. Although foreigners and the market people ate it up. They thought, wow, this is good to go. But anyway, that response to it really challenged us to think of how could we make it more aesthetic. And so we, guided by our goal to recycle materials, we looked at what other kind of scrap materials were around. And so we kind of went through the flour sack and the sugar sack and the cocoa sack and just started adding things. And then, you know, did a project with the local school kids and silkscreened their drawings and put their drawings on the flour sack. And then started putting some local icons, historical figures, images on the flower sack. And people started responding to them a bit better. But in that process, you know, it was such a dynamic process that we started thinking, wow, there's so much more here that we could possibly do. And one thing I've been keenly aware of is just, you know, in a developing country, in these emerging economies, often they're so overwhelmed by the West. They really do believe everything is there. That they really somehow lose sight of the fact that that clay pot is at least as, if not more valuable than that plastic bucket that they're being given. And they're somehow, because Kokrobite Institute runs short-term learning programs in environmental studies, art and design, and we interface with universities and schools and professional development groups, secondary and tertiary education, we have a lot of people coming from around the world. And my young people, my Ghanaian trainees, are always somehow just so touched and overwhelmed how what they take for granted is responded to by the visitors. How much interest people have in those natural materials, and you know how much they love the raffia, and how much they love the tactile feel of all those things that people just think are primitive.
It's a very, I think, important and interesting phenomenon when what you think of as primitive, traditional stuff in the face of a whole new world of consumer products that come from elsewhere, when people from outside start to value that, you start to value it yourself, and then this whole dialogue comes up, and the two sides, the African and the outsiders, really start engaging.
Exactly, and that's all actually I tried to do. I observed that happening, and I tried to create a structure around it to formalize it so that there was a conscious exchange, and that we could somehow use that as a jumping point to start a community of design, a discourse of design. You know, because people still come to Africa and they buy all the little trinkets and the things, and oftentimes people think certain cultures just live in the past, and that's where they are. But to have the opportunity to revisit those skills in the face of this modernity and in the face of what's needed, and you know, with a consciousness about the value of that aesthetic and the use of materials, that kind of combination of function and aesthetic, that in that process we said to ourselves, we want a product. We're going to design something. We're going to develop something that's completely modern. And more than that, we're going to do it in such a way that we're conscious about the environment. We're going to do good and do well. We want to think about doing something, you know, Asase Yeju, caring about Mother Earth, making use, because Africans are very, very, I can speak about Ghana, very good at using, reusing everything. When I was having this conversation with my kids, one of them said, oh, you know, when we were children, you know, sometimes in the village, they would take scraps of materials, the flowers like this and that, and they would put them together to make clothes when you were poor. And I say, what did they call that? Ah, they say, the Ashanti call it Asasawa. I said, but you're Awe, what do you call it? He said, Sasa. I said, okay.
So now these Sasa bags, which will be shown at the Santa Fe Weaving Gallery starting tomorrow, contain not only some of those traditional materials and shells and African fabrics and flower sacks and so on, but also European elements, and it's a real combination. It reminds me, I have to say, I've seen some of them, they're so gorgeous, of how African music has totally taken over things like the electric guitar and other Euro-American, I don't even know what to call them, musical forms. In the same way, there's this conversation which ultimately is a hybrid, but it's still very African.
I think that's a brilliant analogy. That's exactly what it is. And I think that, you know, there's been a kind of gap between looking at traditional African art and then looking at the offspring, which is modern art. And that space in between where the African begins to rearticulate his own reality and imagines and believes that he can live in the present.
We're talking to Renee Neblett. Renee, you have a distinguished and long career as an artist. How did you decide to go to Ghana and found the Kokrobite Institute?
Okay, let me give you a kind of quick synopsis. I mean, I, product of the 60s, I was raised in the States here, and after the movement, I moved to Europe, where I studied at Dusseldorf at the Kunst Academy, and I came back. I was lucky. I had a fellowship at the Bunting Institute, and then I started teaching at a private school. It was at that private school that I was kind of really aware of just how little people, students, knew about Africa. It was really, really interesting to me. And through the course of my studies and being abroad, you know, it occurred to me that Africa really is an old world to the Americas, and really part of all American shared cultural heritage. And I guess I was also responding to the, just how marginalized some students felt in that environment, you know, that they just didn't have references to see themselves in the world. Long story short, I wanted to start a study abroad program that would allow American students to experience Africa, to understand that part of our shared cultural heritage. And so I did that. But in the course of doing that, you know, what's interesting is you, from one perspective, you have a vision of what you want to do. And once you get there, you have the benefit or the boon of another whole perspective. And I got there and I realized there's a whole world here. So many things struck me when I first went there, just the way people use water. You know, the art of using water. You know, there's a sisal tree. I could ask my gardener to, you know, to get some rope, and next thing I know, he's, you know, shaving a sisal plant and weaving rope right in the garden. I mean, I just was kind of overwhelmed. I was just like, God, these are the smartest people I've ever met. You know, but in the meantime, they're thinking everything is across the water. So it just occurred to me that there was a real opportunity for shared skills of dialogue around values, you know, procedure, materials, all of it.
And you've got a couple of young people there who you've really brought up and who are becoming quite accomplished designers themselves.
Yeah, the sky's the limit for these kids. What's fabulous about them is that they're so hands-on, they're so tactical, they were raised doing things, and they don't mind work. And once they're engaged in the material and they get discover the kind of unlimited possibilities of that material in conjunction with other materials and ideas, and start to look at what they're doing critically that way. Because oftentimes, a lot of these skills have been passed on to these young people without the benefit of the same cultural framework that their ancestors did it. And so right. It's a kind of rote thing. They weave, but it's not the same kind of social experience it was 50 years or 100 years ago.
Right.
So in fact, this activity of reviewing, reinvesting, you know, reconsidering is really digging back in the culture. You know, we're just doing it in a kind of modern context.
It's such a beautiful example of what cultural exchange can really be for both sides.
That's what it is. That's really what the world is about, to realize fundamentally that no culture has a monopoly on beauty.
Renee Neblett is an artist and educator, and the Sasa bags that we've been talking about are going to be shown at the Santa Fe Weaving Gallery tomorrow, Thursday, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon at 124 and a half Galisteo Street. And after that, Renee will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening. For more information and directions, please call 505-982-1737. Renee, thanks again for being here.
Thank you, too.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can find us at the podcast site, santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe.foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents the monthly New Orleans Hour.